Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
Hey, everybody. Welcome in. It's David Summers, and here we go. It's another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Here comes the story of wrestling in America as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So now, let's step back into the ring, back into time. Let's get wall-to-wall and tree-top tall with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Hey, congratulations, Ron. You are releasing, this is number 380, the 380th Studcast, and it's Christmas Day 2024. This has to be some kind of an all-time record for a wrestling podcast. Almost every one of these podcasts you have done were over 1 hour in length, and that total undoubtedly amounts to more than 400 hours of total wrestling history and entertainment produced by you in just over 7 years' time. I did the math, and that is more than 17 total 24-hour days of Studcast only. How about that?
Wow. Even broke it down into days and hours, Dave. My goodness, man. You know, well, before we jump into this, man, I want to wish everybody out there a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Great day to be doing one of these on, and one that's like number 380. Wow, can't believe it. I had no idea there had been that many done in the past 7 years. And when I think about how many years are behind us, you know, Dave, I realize that there are still 7 more years at least ahead of us. And those 7 years are actually going to be the most productive of all for me.
Well, your work is not done. I had no idea that your next 7 years, starting in 1980, were the most productive of all. That means this Studcast, focused on the second week in December of 1980, was only the beginning of the best years in your wrestling history. So does it also mean that the next 7 years, if you continue to do Studcast, could be the best of them all?
Well, oddly enough, I don't think there's any doubt about it, Dave. Birmingham was probably our best overall city in my wrestling history. And in today's Studcast, I'm going to be presenting just its fourth Southeastern event. So Birmingham is just getting cranked up at this point. So it had only been open for less than a month, and its best years, all of them, were ahead of it, just like they were basically for me.
See, that thought is hard for me to comprehend, but it certainly ensures fans that the best is yet to come. And speaking of that, you're up for congratulations again today. You also opened your new, on this Christmas Day, you opened your new TennesseeStudStreaming.com channel, all lowercase, TennesseeStudStreaming.com. That channel is now open, and after what I've been seeing there, your best is truly yet to come on there, too. It is absolutely loaded with your wrestling history.
Yeah, and it's only the beginning, Dave. We have hundreds more hours to add, and the channel is just going to continue to grow for years. I mean, I don't expect that we're going to be able that we won't fill this sucker up for years. And I encourage fans to take advantage of my free trial offer. First 3 days are going to be free. So go and check it out, TennesseeStudStreaming.com channel. And you can start today and you can have your first look at it today. And all you need to do, basically, just go to TennesseeStudStreaming.com, as you said, Dave, all of them lowercase letters, and sign up for the free trial. And if you like what you see and you do not cancel after the third day, your membership will begin automatically. And you will be charged the extremely reasonable $4.99 a monthly fee, or you can pay $49.99 for an entire 12 months, which saves you 2 free months there. And so it depends on kind of what level you want to choose. And if you cancel before the free 3 days ends, you owe nothing at all. So if you want to look at it for 3 days and then you decide, I don't know if I'm going to do this, you just let them know, and they don't charge you. There won't be a charge at all.
Cool. You owe nothing. So that's pretty cool. That's a great offer. This whole thing is a great offer. And this Christmas Day Studcast, this very one, will be there too, as well as on all of the normal Studcast outlets, all the way through next week's special New Year's Day Studcast. All right, you've been taking care of all of the bills from your podcast for more than 7 years, covering all the expenses of producing what is today 380 Studcast, as we said earlier. Fans have supported you all the way. I'm sure that support is always going to be there, especially now that you've also built a streaming channel for your fans. So, Ron, can we talk a little bit about an idea you brought up earlier about your new Studcast?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, Dave. I'm glad you mentioned it. You know, I've always thought that an hour is more than enough time to keep someone's attention. And the question is, does my audience have an entire hour to give me? You know, and I've been considering trying some new things. And since we're doing so many new things anyway right now, I mean, why not change up the Studcast a little bit too? So I'd love to have a little fan feedback on what I'm about to propose here. And it's what I've been thinking about for a while now. And I would like to still give fans an hour of total entertainment each week, just like I always have. But I'd like to cut the show into two pieces and maybe at least 30 to 40 minutes each one of them. Part one would be on our normal Wednesdays, which we've always for a long time now, we've always released these Studcasts on Wednesdays. We would release part one on Wednesday, and maybe that one could just be like the card that we do every week. We talk about the card, then we talk about the TV show. And now since we're going to have the actual matches and the actual interviews and the personalities profiles from 44 years ago on these TV shows now, then we can go ahead and give them the results of the matches and the attendances.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
So then maybe 4 days later, let's just say as an example on Sunday, on a weekend on Sunday, do the second half of that show, which would itself be another 30 to 40 minutes on a totally different subject. Something like a weekly, maybe a story time with the stud. And obviously a learning tree question every week. From a fan every week. So people like those so much, I hardly ever get to them anymore because we pack so much into these. Give us fans an opportunity to get something that's totally different. I got enough stories that I could tell stories all day long every day for probably a month or two.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm not going to have a problem doing a story time with a stud. And I'd love to have a learning tree question for the fans every week on the second part. So how about it, fans? When you hear this, I will have already made posts. You're hearing this now. Mm-hmm. All you need to do is go to Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud Facebook page, and I'll have a little message there for you, and you can put your response there, what you think about this idea.
All right, I can't wait to hear what the fans think about this idea. And speaking of ideas, where are we going to start this? Where do we ride today, Stud?
Well, we're going to begin with a little update, man, on basically the changing of the crew that was going on in the second week of December 1980, and the tremendous difference in talent that we're going to see here in this change of this crew, and why that mattered so much. And then we're going to get into our card of the week, like I just explained before, what we're going to maybe start doing in the first part of our part one of our new studcast. Mm-hmm. We're going to be talking about the card. This the one time we will be talking about. We'll be talking about the card of December 19, second week, the December of 1980, and you know, we'll be also talking about the results of the matches in this. We'll talk about the TV that promoted it. We'll talk about the attendances in the four major markets. And hopefully, Dave, we're going to have enough time for another learning tree in this one.
All right, good deal. I totally agree with that, Stud. I mean, do you want to begin with that changing of the crew in 1980 and why that mattered so much?
I think that's a great place to start, man. We are basically in this studcast focusing on the second week in December of 1980. So let's go back. I want to go back 8 months from where we are in December of 1980 to, I want to start on April the 1st, 1980, just so I can remind fans of who was in this crew back 8 months ago. And so let's talk about the heels in that crew to begin with. Mongolian Stomper and his manager, Big C, were beginning to just kind of start getting over there. They had just kind of come back into the territory. Jimmy Golden had just turned heel. Norvell Austin and Big Ron Bass had just arrived into the territory along with Stomper and Big C. And Don Fargo, Randy Rose, and Dr. Bill Irwin, they were already there and had been there for a while. And that kind of filled out that eight-man heel crew. The babyfaces were at that point, there was a masked man called the Georgia Jawjacker, who everybody knows as Bob Armstrong.
Yeah.
Joe LeDuc, I was here in the territory. Rob was working in the territory. Tony Charles was a star, had been there for quite a while. Then along came Charlie Cook. Eddie Boulder, who's going to be the future Brutus the Barber Beefcake for WWF back in the days, or WWE, whichever one it was. Roy Lee Welch and Ricky Fields was in that crew. So basically, there's about nine baby faces on that side of the crew. So some of these wrestlers on both sides were still remaining in the crew 8 months later. We're going to talk about now. Let's talk about. Or jump into December of 1980. And before we get to that, though, I want to talk about there was a real catastrophe occurred, man. It was on that card of April the 1st, 1980, when my cousin Jimmy Golden, member of the Welch family, injured himself so badly that he had to give up the sport. He moved away from Pensacola and he retired from wrestling. Horrible deal.
All right, I do remember that match. It was an eight-man tag match, and I believe you and Robert were on the opposing team when it happened. I think he went to slam Joe LeDuc and collapsed with 300 pounds plus of the lumberjack landing on top of himself.
Yes, man. Wow. I mean, you know, and at this point, in the second week of December 1980, he's still out of wrestling 8 months later. And it was one of the most horrific accidents that I, to this day, ever witnessed in the ring. Because I guess he's a family member. And I basically, Dave, had a hard time getting past it. I thought I would never get over it. It was really, really a horrible sight to see. So let's move forward. Back to the second week in December of 1980. And let's talk about this new incoming crew. and those that are going to soon be leaving, the guys that are going to be leaving, and then we'll talk about the newcomers. So on the new crew for the baby faces, was a bunch of guys who were familiar to fans. And now one of those guys happened to wear a mask, you know, and that had to be me, the Tennessee Stud. And I'd only had a handful of matches, but I was already making a name for myself, basically. We'll start off with me arriving there in December of 1980.
All right, let me guess. The Tennessee Stud was one, and the other had to be Brad Armstrong. He was the talk of wrestling almost from his first match in Southeastern. So who else knew was there?
Brad was a trip, man. I mean, I could never get over how fast Brad Armstrong got over in that territory. Fans really loved him. So we had a new guy coming. This guy was coming from New York City, man. And I mean, he's one of the Valiant brothers, Johnny Valiant. And he was going to be followed 4 weeks later by that Welch family member that I just talked about. He suffered that horrible accident 8 months earlier. Jimmy Golden was going to come back to wrestling. And he came back with a totally different attitude than he had when he left. Then the week after Jimmy Golden came back, a very young future Hall of Fame wrestler was awesome. And we were so lucky to get our hands on him. Paul Orndorff was going to make his Southeastern debut. 2 weeks after Orndorff, another Pensacola-born wrestler came home, basically, Robert Gibson. And Robert Gibson, obviously, everybody's going to know and remember mostly as part of one of the most famous tag teams in wrestling history, the Rock and Roll Express.
Yeah.
And then to top that off, after 3 weeks after Gibson arrived, Ken Lucas, one of the most popular wrestlers in Gulf Coast history, made his first ever Southeastern appearance.
I'm curious, do you remember how tall Ken Lucas was?
He was probably, I'm just going to guess, 5'10".
He was not one of the biggest guys, but he was one of the most fun to watch in the ring. And I always remember he might have been shorter than anybody in the ring that he ever competed with. But man, he sure made up for it. All right, so you didn't just change the crew. You loaded it with big names. So what stars did you find for the other dressing room?
Okay, I'll get to that in just a minute, but I want to talk a little bit about Ken myself. Okay. It was my first experience to ever have Ken Lucas in my territory. Hmm. And I had heard a whole lot about Ken for many, many years. I had never even met him until he came in for me in December. Mm-hmm. I guess it was January, basically, of 1981. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what, man, what impressed me immediately was that guy was a ball of fire. I mean, when he made a comeback and when he got mad, you know, there weren't many guys that could do the Ken Lucas thing. And he was really, really great. The other dressing room over there where the heels was, we already had Big Ron Bass in the crew at this point in December of 1980. We had Jerry Stubbs, we had Randy Rose, and we had just brought in a new guy to partner up with Randy Rose, his cousin, Dennis Condrey. And he was in just his second week in the territory, and he and Randy Rose had already become the Southeastern Tag Champions. So obviously he was going to be a big, he was going to play a huge role in the next year or so of Southeastern. Then we get the first of two Japanese wrestlers that came into the territory. Oki Shikino was the first one to arrive, and he arrived last week on the last Studcast. Oki was all right, but man, the real fine arrived the next week, and and he was going to be wrestling on this studcast. And we didn't know really what to call him, and he didn't know really what to call himself either. So we kind of named him Mr. Saito. His last name was Saito, but we threw the Mr. on because, with good reason, I mean, everybody that wrestled him had nothing but respect for this dude. I mean, he was 100% bona fide fine. He was a crazy good. Southeastern was one of his first territories. And when he came to this country, he ran through a bunch of American territories like a house of fire, man. He stayed with us longer, I think, than he did in any other territory he worked in America. But this guy was a true student of the sport. And I mean, he was there to learn everything he could. And when he returned to Japan, he became the best trainer in Japanese history. He was a phenom in Japan as well. So there were two other wrestlers in the babyface dressing room during this time frame in December that are good baby faces, hot baby faces, on top. People really like them. But they are both going to do something to turn things upside down, and they're going to become maybe two of the hottest heels in the entire territory.
Well, it sounds like you are going to need bigger buildings with this new crew. I mean, you want to give us the card, and let's go ahead and set it up that was used in all four major markets, and we're going back to the second week of December, 1980. Lay that out for us, Dud.
Okay, the opening match was Charlie Cook against Oki Shikina. Ricky Fields wasn't going to have a very good night, man. He was facing Mr. Saito. For the United States Junior Heavyweight Belt, Jerry Stubbs was demanding a no disqualification championship return match with the new champion, Norvell Austin. He didn't like it that he couldn't win the first time. He wanted to have another one. Johnny Valiant was facing the Mongolian Stomper, with Don Carson banned from ringside. The Tennessee Stud was defending his newly won Southeastern belt against Don Carson. And for the Southeastern Tag Championships, Bob and Brad Armstrong were finally going to get their return match against the new tag champions, because those champions won the belts from the Armstrongs, and they wouldn't give them a return match. So now they're going to get that return match. The main event for this card was a very dangerous bull rope match. Those matches were, wow, horrible. Horrible, dude, to watch even as a wrestler. I mean, and the fans, I don't know how they dealt with some of these. You know, and this one had Ron Bass bringing his bull rope to the ring and having himself strapped to Joe LeDuc. And one man could pull his opponent around the ring, touch every turnbuckle two times. I mean, it was a highly involved match, and wow, most often very bloody one.
Yeah, I kind of forget about what the bull rope match consists of, but once you had the rope around them, you had to tag all four corner posts, right?
Right.
Okay.
Drag them around the ring and tag every post.
And how much did Ron Bass weigh? You had to drag that big bull. He was, what was he, 300 pounds?
Oh, yeah.
At least. Man, that was a great card, Stud. Valiant versus Stomper, three championship matches, and a bull rope match on top of all that. Yeah, I tell you what, this is a good place for a break. Let's do that. When we come back, we're going to find out how you covered all of those matches in 1 hour. That is coming up when this Studcast continues. All right, Studcast fans, once again, Merry Christmas. Don't miss the next Studcast on New Year's Day, Wednesday, January 1st, 2025. It's going to be the first Studcast in history to show much of an actual match from 44 years ago, December 1980. A double loser leaves tag match with the Mongolian Stomper and Don Carson versus the Tennessee Stud and Bob Armstrong. And both losers must leave Southeastern. It's the first of the new Studcast Ron has been describing for so long now. Also, don't forget, you can start your free 3-day trial today of the Stud's new streaming channel. TennesseeStudStreaming.com with all lowercase letters. New Studcast and the streaming channel is going to make the stud shows better than ever. All right, Studcast fans, welcome back in. Studcast number 380, entitled Merry Christmas, Ron's Grandfather Roy. All right, you had your hands full trying to put together a TV show for the tremendous card you introduced just before the break. So how did the TV show begin? Set it up for us.
It's coming out of the regular opening. We had an opening that we had developed and had used for years. Just in the little shots of action shots and things. And coming directly out of that opening, we went straight into a match that was already in progress. It was between the champion, the Mongolian Stomper, and the new masked Tennessee Stud, who was in his first week ever in Southeastern Gulf Coast. He'd never been wrestling under a mask in the Gulf Coast territory before. It was taped from Birmingham, Alabama, where there were more than 5,000 fans on a December night. Pretty darn amazing. And because those fans there, they were wrestling starved. This was only their fourth event in the past year. I mean, they had gone almost a year in Birmingham with no wrestling at all. Now this was going to be their fourth event, and they were really supporting wrestling big time again. So this one opened up with the Tennessee Stud making up for lost time and whipping the Mongolian Stomper's rear end basically all over the ring. And finally put him into the fuller leg lock and for basically a for sure victory. Stomper's manager, Don Carson, on the outside of the ring, as usual, as soon as that happened, he knew that it was over, and he started loading his black glove and started crawling up on the apron in the ring and headed in. Obviously, he was going to get his man disqualified, you know, but he was going to save his leg. I'm sure that's what he was thinking. And, you know, and all of a sudden, here came Johnny Valiant again, from New York City, and he grabbed Carson from behind and he drug him off the apron. He ran him head first into the steel ring post, and he walked quietly back to the dressing room. Birmingham crowd popped, and so did the studio crowd when they saw this on the TV monitors. And Tennessee Stud got his hand raised, and he was handed the belt as the new Southeastern champion. The video ended with the Stud at the set. Had the belt in front of him. He was sitting between Charlie Platt and Les Thatcher, two commentators, and had another big round of applause. The masked man thanked everybody for the great reception and said how great it was to be back in action after months of being home.
All right, cool. Who was in the first TV match?
Well, the man that had just lost the belt to the Stud the week before, the Mongolian Stomper.
All right. Oh, boy. I bet I know what happened next.
Well, now, not this time, Dave.
What? You know,
the Stomper, you know, he was followed very closely by Don Carson, came out right behind the Stomper. Stomper's kind of headed for, you know, where, you know, he's prepared to attack the fans as he usually did. But sitting on the front row, right in the middle of the fans, in the bleachers, was the New York City's Johnny Valiant. And all the fans were, at that point, extremely happy to see him because they knew what was coming. Well, the Stomper, he had a whoa. He was almost running to get to him, and he sees him sitting there, and he said, whoa. He pulled up, and he came back to the ring, and he got in the ring. But you could tell he was angry because he didn't get to chase his fans all over the studio like he normally did. So as soon as the bell rang, he took that anger out on his opponent. The Tennessee Stud was scheduled the following week for his first title defense against the Stomper's manager, Don Carson. And Johnny Valiant, who was sitting in the front row of the TV studio, was going to be facing the Mongolian Stomper on that next card. So it didn't take Stomper long to get tired of picking his opponent up off the mat, you know, just because as soon as he picked him up and shot him in the ropes, he put him back on the mat again, stomping him to pieces. And so he finally got tired of that, and he finished him off, man. he shot him in there and he kicked him in the stomach. And as happened with a lot of guys, the stomper had a, must have had a 16 shoe. I don't know how big his feet were, but his boots were huge. And he put that boot in this kid, in the kid's belly, and the boy kind of just fell on face first, and he rolled over. That was a mistake because Stomper went to the ropes, and when he came back, he stomped him right in the face. And wow, the kid got a bloody nose, and undoubtedly he got a horrible headache to go with it.
I imagine so. Okay, what about the second segment of the TV show?
Well, this was a new wrestler to everybody, and even to the wrestlers in the TV station. I mean, this was fresh from Japan, man, Mr. Saito. I mean, this is his first stop in America, and happened to be in the Southeastern Territory. And so, you know, everybody, when that kind of happens, and this guy was he was big for a Japanese guy. He was stout and very well put together. And so every one of the guys in the, at least our dressing room, and I'm sure in the other dressing room too, they all got up close to the TV. Let's take a look at this guy, right? And wow, this Mr. Saito, I got to say, he was one of the baddest Japanese wrestlers any of us had ever seen. And basically, he could do it all. I mean, he was using... a lightning fast that started out the match. The very first thing he did is he did this Japanese leg sweep that was so fast you couldn't see how he did the move. And he came up with the guy in a pinning position. He could have won within 10 seconds if he had wanted to, but then he just got off of the guy, lit him up, and the guy that he was wrestling. And it was just the beginning, first move of the match, and everybody in the dressing room went, oh, what was that? And then on the end of the match, he completed it. He used three suplexes back to back, all three of them that I had never seen anybody do.
Wow.
All three of them totally different than suplexes that American wrestlers did. And that left everybody in the dressing room with their mouth open. And the studio crowd were just the same as the wrestlers. They were in awe too. They showed a couple of fans sitting with their mouths open in the stands. Like, wow, this guy is good, man.
Yeah.
So he was basically one of the few men that could rival the Stomper when it came to dishing out punishment. So talk about it, making a good impression. Boy, this chap made an everlasting impression.
I think I do remember him, Ron. He would, who could forget him? He scared me like no other Japanese wrestler I ever saw. So I can't remember who was wrestling him on the upcoming card.
Well, the card in the arenas, it was Ricky Fields. But actually, Ricky was on that TV, and we put Ricky in the ring with him. So Ricky was the poor dude that was getting all these suplexes, and everybody was just feeling sorry for him, you know. And and it was Saito's first TV show in the territory. And wow, when you went into a new territory, you wanted to create an impression. And boy, did this dude make a great impression that first day.
This was going to be a long week for poor Ricky. All right, so let's go to the personality profile. That was next, right?
Yeah, it was going to be done in two studios, like the profile we did the week before. And it was based upon the upcoming extremely dangerous bull rope match that was Ron Bass's favorite match. But no doubt about that. So Bass was in the main studio on the personality profile set with Charlie Platt, and Les Thatcher was over in what we call Studio B with Joe LeDuc. And both men were still patched up from the Texas Death Match that they'd had the week before, where I don't know how much blood there was, and the good thing we probably didn't have to measure it. Because, well, it was everywhere. And so both of them, you know, they were they were really ready for this one. And, you know, but they looked like they'd already had a war and they were about to have a real war now. Charlie started things off with Ron Bass, and Bass had brought out his bull rope with him, and he brought a prop along with him. And he was going to use this prop in the profile. So Bass began by explaining the rules of the bull rope match, you know, for those that didn't know. And you could see his eyes light up, man, with enjoyment, just talking about it, you know, what was going to happen, you know. And I, you do this, and then you do that. Oh, he was really into it. And both men, you know, he basically explained that both guys are going to get strapped together here with the bull rope. And he showed them the rope and he laid it out. It's 12 feet long. And then he showed the big, huge cowbell that was connected right in the middle of it. And then he says, in order to win the match, he says, basically, he said, you have to beat your opponent up so badly that you can drag him around the ring twice and touch each one of the turnbuckles in each corner as you go.
Wow. So, I mean, I would have already been beat if it were me, but I could never have drug either of those two 300-pound giants around the ring twice, much less have to beat them up first. So what kind of prop? I want to hear about the prop that Ron Bass had. What was that?
All right. So it was definitely a crazy match for anybody that ever got in one of those. I mean, it was like, wow, you had to be a little off to even want to compete in something like that. So, you know, but you had two perfect guys, Ron Bass and Joe LeDuc, man, and they met that criteria of being crazy. And so Bass's prop was a life-size plastic, one of those styrofoam-shaped heads that you see in you know, in some department stores and I guess in beauty shops and things like that, you know. And so Charlie asked Bass, he says, why'd you bring this out here, you know? And so Bass smiled and he said, I brought this out here, Charlie Platt, to show you what a steel bell can do to somebody's head. So he raised the bell high up over his head. He held that styrofoam head in his hand, and he drove those sharp edges of that bell down on that top of that styrofoam head. And about half of it, a huge chunk of it, went flying off across the studio floor over to where the fans were in the bleachers. Some of the fans nearby, they screamed, man, like, oh, gosh, what? And then so Bass lit up like a Christmas tree. I mean, he was into it. And so he took two or three real quick whacks at what was left of the head. And he started laughing hysterically and chunks were flying everywhere. And Charlie's trying to get, wait a minute. Charlie's trying to get control. And Charlie couldn't handle any more of it because he could tell that neither could the fans on the nearby bleachers, you know. So he threw the rest of the profile pretty quickly to his fellow commentator, Les Thatcher, who was standing by over there in Studio B with Joe LeDuc. So when Bob Armstrong and I, we're back in the dressing room watching the monitor, we see what Joe LeDuc had in his hand, you know. And Joe was really crazy. You would give him a profile and you never knew what he was going to do with it, you know. And so this time, I guess he knew he was in the profile and he went out and he brought in what me and Bob saw and we almost fainted. I mean, what the fans had just witnessed was basically nothing, man, compared to what Joe LeDuc was wanting to do with what he brought in. So thank goodness Les had seen this act before, back in 1977, when Joe LeDuc almost had his neck broken on TV in Knoxville. Mongolian Stomper had put a concrete block on Joe's head, and the Stompers took the sledgehammer away from Gorgeous George Jr. and hit Joe LeDuc on the top of the head with that sledgehammer, and it put Joe in the hospital for almost a month.
Wow. All right. So what did Joe LeDuc have in his hand?
Well, thankfully, like I said, Les had seen this before. And so after Joe got hurt and was in the hospital for a month and he came back to wrestle against the Stomper, this was in 1977. What Joe had in his hand was a lumberjack's axe, and he was planning on using it on himself, you know, and what he did in Knoxville, and nobody knew he was going to do this. He sat down there in a chair right next to Les, and Les was doing the profile with him, and he brought his axe out, and then he made a blood oath. And then Joe LeDuc in that French accent, I'd make blood oath that I'm going to take care of that Stomper. And he took that axe and he put it on his forearm. He put his arm out there, right there. And we got the close-up. I remember being upstairs and I didn't know what he was going to do. And I told the director, I said, get a close-up of that. And you could see the blade of the axe laying on the inside of his arm. And he started pulling that axe across his arm. Blood went off both sides. I mean, I said, get back. I'm trying to direct the show. Oh my God, what's he doing? Right, we're gonna lose our TV. I mean, so, and it happened live, right? I mean, it was too late to stop it. And Les was screaming like, no, Joe, no. It was like, wow. So we were about to see that again now down here in the Gulf Coast territory.
Okay, so pull in close. No, pull back. All right, you got to be kidding. That's crazy. So no wonder Les pulled the plug on LeDuc. All right, that could have got you. I mean, I assume that if you do too much of that, especially back then, that could have gotten you thrown off TV for good. All right, I've been saying for a while now that these personality profiles are getting better and better, but I don't know how to even rate this one, period. All right, so how about the next TV segment? Let's move on to that one.
Well, Jerry Stubbs started it off. He was watching the video of his regaining the United States Junior Heavyweight belt from Norvell Austin. Again, they'd been swapping this belt back and forth for probably 6 weeks. And again, Stubbs promised the fans, as he always cockily did, that he was not going to ever get beat by Norvell Austin again. And he says, I don't care. I know I'm facing him in a return match, but it's going to do him no good. I'm just going to hurt him. He's just going to keep getting hurt worse.
Okay, so who was in the live match?
Well, the man Stubbs had been talking about, Norvell Austin. And so Norvell, he seemed like, man, he was more determined than ever to win the belt back. And basically, he showed how determined he was, man. And in just a few minutes that he was in the ring, because he hit his opponent with one of the most beautiful diving headbutts that I'd ever seen, man. And Norvell was becoming famous for that move. And he had that old hard head anyway, man. And when he would left the ring, he was probably a good 10 feet away from the guy and his forehead connected with the guy's forehead. Wow. I was like, wow, man, this is getting punished. It's becoming a wild TV.
All right. So how about the last TV segment?
Well, the Southeastern Tag Team Champions, Dennis Condrey and Randy Rose, they joined Charlie Platt and Les at the set, and they watched their successful title defense from the week before against Bob Armstrong and Charlie Cook. Now, they made Bob, they would not allow Bob to have Brad as his partner. They said that you can't, that we won't defend against you and Brad, even though we should be defending against you and giving you a return match. You got to pick a partner. Bob Armstrong picked Charlie Cook, and they beat Charlie Cook. And so they showed that video. And then they complained about having to face now not just one of the Armstrongs, but both of them the following week. And they were reminded basically by both Les and Charlie that the Armstrongs, should have had that match last week. They deserved it. They were the former champions. They didn't get a return match, and they basically said, "We don't feel sorry for you guys. you're gonna have to wrestle a darn good team now."
Okay, so what about? Let's go to the ring. I think for the last TV match.
Well, that was Bob Armstrong and Brad, and the fact that the champions Convy and Rose were still at the sit during this match. Once they saw that who was in the ring, they said, "Hey, we're staying here and watching the match, whether you guys like it or not." And because they were so close to the ring, probably only about 15 feet away from the sit, I think that made the Armstrongs an even better team because they wanted to make an example out of what they were going to do to those dudes, and they did a pretty darn good job of it. They took care of business, I guess is a good way of putting it. And during the course of the match, Bob even felt comfortable enough that he got out of the ring and he went almost all the way over to the set to taunt Condry and Rose. And while that was going on, it kind of allowed Brad to show how much he was improving from week after week. He basically, Bob's over there confronting the two guys that they're going to wrestle. And both the guys started to take care of Brad, and Brad was beating the heck out of both of them. So Bob didn't even have to worry about going back to the ring. And Brad even finished the match while Bob's over there jawing with the two guys. And he used that Russian leg sweep again that won that little beautiful little flyover and covered his guy. Wow. He was becoming a phenom, that kid.
Absolutely. That was another really good TV show. But I still can't get over that personality profile. All right, so take us to the arenas. What happened the next week in the arenas?
Well, Charlie Cook got a win over Oki Shikina, one of the two Japanese. And as I said earlier, Mr. Saito not only impressed the wrestlers, but wow, he impressed all those fans in every one of those cities, man. And during the course of that match, there were many oohs and ahs from the crowd. They were, ooh, whoa. It's like, oh, my gosh. And it was poor little Ricky Fields that was taking all that. Jerry Stubbs managed to successfully defend his United States Junior Heavyweight belt for the second week in a row against Norvell Austin. Johnny Valiant had his first real test against the Mongolian Stomper. Don Carson was barred from ringside. And those two guys wrestled to a 30-minute time limit draw. One of the few times I saw anybody ever hold a Stomper to a 30-minute draw. What a great match, too. Johnny Valiant was a different type of character. Let's just put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Then in the last match, I successfully defeated Don Carson for the belt, and I kept it. But I had to deal with the Mongolian Stomper at the end of that match. He did come down, and when he came down, Johnny Valiant came down, too. We all four of us at this point got into it. And then Johnny got hit with a shot, man, from Stomper that about knocked him out, and I had to help him back to the dressing room. So in the Southeastern Tag Championship match, Dennis Condry, Randy Rose, I got a little ahead of myself here. They intentionally got themselves disqualified, and they did that to save their belts because the Armstrongs were, wow, the Armstrongs were every bit as good as that team of Convy and Rose. Those four guys had some of the greatest tag matches I ever saw. The bull rope match was really wild, and it was bloody. I'll just leave it at that. Both men were able to pull the other one around the ring about one time each. They'd get one whole circle one time. Then toward the end of the match, the Duke got Bass around the ring once, and he started around for that second time. He touched six of those posts, and he only had to touch two more. But Bass was able to remove himself from the rope that was tied to his wrist. And as soon as he did that, he just slid out of the ring and went to the dressing room. Obviously, referee counted him out. LeDuc was declared the winner, and he ended up keeping Ron Bass's bull rope.
Hmm. All right. So I bet you did good on this one. So how about the attendances for the four major cities?
Well, Mobile had 4,700. Montgomery, now this is the second week in December, and I've already mentioned that December is the hardest month of the year in wrestling, and most territories were doing less than half of what we were doing at this point. Mobile had 4,700. Montgomery had 3,400. Dothan got back over 4,000 to 4,100. And Birmingham had 5,300 fans. So the total for all four of those cities was 17,500 fans. Now, when you add a Pensacola to it, which had 4,000 fans, and Panama City that had 3,000 fans that same week, if you added up all the total for the six cities, it was 24,500 fans on the second week in December. That was a remarkable feat for any territory in the country.
Especially that time of year, no doubt about it. This has been another very interesting Studcast. You have so many things happening every week now, Ron. I'm really looking forward to the next Studcast, which is going to be on New Year's Day. All right, so it's going to be the first Studcast ever to have a live match on it, right?
Correct. Yes, it is, man. And it's not just any match, too, Dave. I mean, it's going to have a really, really important match, one that we'd never done before. For the first time ever, there was going to be a tag match. Johnny Valiant had gotten involved in this match that I talked about with me against Don Carson and the Mongolian Stomper, and me and Johnny fighting at the end of it. Johnny got smacked in the head and had to help him back to the dressing room. So we were going to come back next in the next Studcast, wrestling against each other, me and Valiant against Stomper and Carson. And the losers of that match have to both leave Southeastern. Not just one person, but both of them. The entire team leaves.
Wow. Okay. All right. I do have one more surprise for you, Stud. We do have enough time for a learning tree question, and I'm very happy about this one. It's special for several reasons, one being the time of year. It's based upon one of your most recent When Wrestling Was Wrestling post that you often put on Facebook and Twitter pages as well. This one is about your grandfather and his birthday on December 19th, 1901. Okay, so Stud, please read to fans what you posted on those sites just 6 days ago, and then we would love for you to read one of the responses from a fan about it.
Okay. Yeah, I don't mind doing that. Just a little bit of reference, though, for those people that may not know what these posts that I do every once in a while. Actually, I do at least once for a month, and I take wrestlers that I've had matches with. I call it When Wrestling Was Wrestling, because basically wrestling today is not what wrestling was back in the day. And I talk about wrestling, all types of different opponents. And then basically on this particular When Wrestling Was Wrestling that I picked about 5-7 days ago now, I picked my grandfather because it was close to his birthday. And, so that was my subject matter. And I had a lot of responses. Wow. And I used a picture that was of Roy when he was in his early 20s, just a young man, a classic, absolutely classic wrestling picture, like they all used to take him back in the day. He's sitting on a stool. And, got his trunks on. Wow. I really appreciate, you guys picking this out. I think it's a great choice today. And I'm looking forward to the responses. So here's what I put. I said, when wrestling was wrestling, December 19th, 1901, mm-hmm. 123 years ago on this day, my grandfather, Roy Welch, was born. He died on September 27, 1977. During his 76 years of life, he built one of the largest territories in the history of wrestling and founded the largest and oldest wrestling family ever, and built also one of the largest dairies in the history of the South. God rest his soul.
Wow. Okay. I think this is really strong. So please read the fan's response.
Okay, so a gentleman, I guess, named Frankie Culpepper, this is what Frankie had to say about my post. He says, man, what a classic picture. It should have gone in every sports encyclopedia and school history books the moment it was snapped. I wonder if anyone knew of the impact he would have today. Then he has another paragraph here. He says, just imagine the lives he changed. Not just the wrestlers that would make a great living, but the fans that got consistent entertainment every week. That alone may have changed the whole course of wrestling history. Wow, Frankie, I really don't know what to say much about it. You know, if Roy hadn't have come along, I certainly would have never been here, and neither would my father, and all the members basically of the largest wrestling family in history would have never been here, and maybe none of what happened through my family's part of this would have happened. And this post, basically, I put up a picture. I put a picture on every one of these studcasts. And on this one, I'm going to put the picture of my grandfather. He was probably, like I said, maybe in his early 20s. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm going to do that as a tribute to Roy. And since he was born so close to Christmas, it's a perfect time for it to put that photo there. And that's where I'm going to, fans want to take a look at my granddad. I'm going to guess that the year was 1924, maybe his first year as a wrestler. I think you will enjoy it. And I got to thank you, Frankie, Mr. Culpepper, for your very thoughtful comments. And you made me that you made about Roy. And I think he would probably be pretty proud, basically, of what I'm trying to do today, Dave, for fans in my own time frame here, you know,
no doubt. Yeah.
Streaming channel, new studcast. I'm still pushing when wrestling was wrestling.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'd like to end this studcast today a little different than what we normally do. One more time, I'd like to wish everybody a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. To everybody out there, and please don't forget the one we owe everything to this time of year, and may God bless us all.
Merry Christmas to you, Stud. God bless you, and thank you for so many of these studcasts. This is wrapping up number 380. How about that? For Ron Fuller in the Great Smoky Mountains, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. This studcast is a David Summers production. For Tennessee Stud, LLC.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.